She dropped to her knees in the muddy garden and abruptly began chopping sharp-root vines, tossing the roots themselves toward the side of the house with quick, accurate throws. "There's nothing between 'em, I'd know. Children of such an age have no more discretion than the drunks in the rest." But the way they had smiled, the way they had smiled at each other. "Perfectly normal," she whispered, chopping and throwing. She cut a sharp root nearly in half, ruining it, not noticing. The whispering was a habit she'd picked up only recently, as reap day neared and the stresses of coping with her brother's troublesome daughter mounted. "Folks smile at each other, that's all." The same for the salute and Susan's returning wave. Below, the handsome cavalier acknowledging the pretty maid. Above, the maid herself, pleased to be acknowledged by such as he. It was youth calling to youth, that was all. And yet, the look in his eyes, and the look in hers. Nonsense, of course. But you saw something else. Yes, perhaps. For a moment it had seemed to her that the young man was going to blow Susan a kiss, then had remembered himself at the last moment and turned it into a salute instead. "Even if he did see such a thing, it means nothing. Young cavaliers are saucy, especially when out from beneath the gaze of their fathers, and these three already have a history, as you well know." All true enough, but none of it removed that chilly splinter from her heart. 5. Jonas answered Roland's knock and let the two boys into the sheriff's office. He was wearing a deputy star on his shirt and looked at them with expressionless eyes. "Boys," he said, "come in out of the wet." He stepped back to allow them entrance. His limp was more pronounced than Roland had ever seen it. The wet weather was playing it up, he supposed. Roland and Cuthbert stepped in. There was a gas heater in the corner filled from the candle at Sitgo, no doubt, and the big room, which had been cool on the day when they had first come here, was stuporously hot. The three cells held 5 woeful-looking drunks, 2 pairs of men, and a woman in the center cell by herself, sitting on the bunk with her legs spread wide, displaying a broad expanse of red drawers. Roland feared that if she got her finger any farther up her nose, she might never retrieve it. Clay Reynolds was leaning against the notice board, picking his teeth with a broom straw. Sitting at the roll-top desk was Deputy Dave, stroking his chin and frowning through his monocle at the board which had been set up there. Roland wasn't at all surprised to see that he and Bert had interrupted a game of castles.
"Well, look here, Eldred," Reynolds said. "It's 2 of the in-world boys. Do your mommies know you're out, fellas?"
"They do," Cuthbert said brightly. "And you're looking very well, Si Reynolds. The wet weather soothed your pox, has it?" Without looking at Bert or losing his pleasant little smile, Roland shot an elbow into his friend's shoulder. "Pardon my friend, Si. His humor regularly transgresses the bounds of good taste. He doesn't seem able to help it. There's no need for us to scratch at one another. We've agreed to let bygones be bygones, haven't we?"
"Aye, certainly. All a misunderstanding," Jonas said.
He limped back across to the desk and the game board. As he sat down, on his side of it, his smile turned to a sour little grimace.
"I'm worse than an old dog," he said. "Someone ought to put me down, so they should. Earth's cold but painless, eh, boys?"
He looked back at the board and moved a man around to the side of his hillock. He had begun to castle and was thus vulnerable. Although not very, in this case, Roland thought, Deputy Dave didn't look like much in the way of competition. "I see you're working for the Barony Salt now," Roland said, nodding at the star on Jonas's shirt.
"Salt's what it amounts to," Jonas said, companionably enough. "A fella went leg broke. I'm helping out, that's all."
"And Si Reynolds? Si DePape, are they helping out as well?"
"Yeah, I reckon," Jonas said. "How goes your work among the fisher folk? Slow, I hear."
"Done, at last. The work wasn't so slow as we were. But coming here in disgrace was enough for us. We have no intention of leaving that way. Slow and steady wins the race, they say."
"So they do,"
Jonas agreed, whoever they are. From somewhere deeper in the building, there came the whoosh of a water stool flushing. All the comforts of home in the Hambry Sheriff's, Roland thought. The flush was soon followed by heavy footsteps descending a staircase, and a few moments later, Herc Avery appeared. With one hand, he was buckling his belt. With the other, he mopped his broad and sweaty forehead. Roland admired the man's dexterity.
Phew! The sheriff exclaimed. Them beans I ate last night took the shortcut, I tell you.
He looked from Roland to Cuthbert and then back to Roland.
Why, boys, too wet for net counting, is it?
Cy Dearborn was just saying that their net counting days are at an end, Jonas said. He combed back his long hair with the tips of his fingers. Beyond him, Clay Reynolds had resumed his slouch against the notice board, looking at Roland and Cuthbert with open dislike.
Aye? Well, that's fine. What's next, youngsters? And is there any way we here can help you? For that's what we like to do best. Lend a hand where hand's needed, so it is.
Actually, you could help us, Roland said. He reached into his belt and pulled out the list. We have to move on to the drop, but we don't want to inconvenience anyone. Grinning hugely, Deputy Dave slid his squire all the way around his own hillock. Jonas castled at once, ripping open Dave's entire left flank. The grin faded from Dave's face, leaving a puzzled emptiness.
How'd you manage that?
Easy,
Jonas smiled, then pushed back from the desk to include the others in his regard.
You want to remember, Dave, that I play to win. I can't help it. It's just my nature.
He turned his full attention to Roland. His smile broadened.
Like the scorpion said to the maiden as she lay dying, you knowed I was poison when you picked me up.
6. When Susan came in from feeding the livestock, she went directly to the cold pantry for the juice, which was her habit. She didn't see her aunt standing in the chimney corner and watching her, and when Cordelia spoke, Susan was startled badly. It wasn't just the unexpectedness of the voice. It was the coldness of it.
Do you know him?
The juice jug slipped in her fingers, and Susan put a steadying hand beneath it. Orange juice was too precious to waste, especially this late in the year. She turned and saw her aunt by the woodbox. Cordelia had hung her sombrero on a hook in the entryway, but she still wore her serape and muddy boots. Her cuchillo lay on top of the stacked wood, with green strands of sharp-root vine still trailing from its edge. Her tone was cold, but her eyes were hot with suspicion. A sudden clarity filled Susan's mind and all of her senses. If you say no, you're damned, she thought. If you even ask who, you may be damned. You must say,
I know them both, she replied in offhand fashion. I met them at the party. So did you. You frightened me, aunt.
Why did he salute ye so?
How can I know? Perhaps he just felt like it.
Her aunt bolted forward, slipped in her muddy boots, regained her balance, and seized Susan by the arms. Now her eyes were blazing.
Bean't insolent with me, girl. Bean't haughty with me, Miss Oh-So-Young and Pretty, or else
Susan pulled backward so hard that Cordelia staggered and might have fallen again if the table had not been handy to grab. Behind her, muddy foot tracks stood out on the clean kitchen floor like accusations.
Call me that again, and I'll slap thee, Susan cried. So I will.
Cordelia's lips drew back from her teeth in a dry, ferocious smile.
Ye'd slap your father's only living blood kin? Would ye be so bad?
Why not? Do ye not slap me, aunt?
Some of the heat went out of her aunt's eyes, and the smile left her mouth.
Susan, hardly ever. Not half a dozen times since you were a toddler who would grab anything her hands could reach, even a pot of boiling water on the...
It's with thy mouth thee mostly hits nowadays, Susan said.
I've put up with it, more fool me, but am done with it now. I'll have no more. If I'm old enough to be sent to a man's bed for money, I'm old enough for ye to keep a civil tongue when you speak to me.
Cordelia opened her mouth to defend herself. The girl's anger had startled her, and so had her accusations.
And then she realized how cleverly she was being led away from the subject of the boys. Of the boy. "Ye only know him from the party, Susan. It's Dearborn, I mean. As I think ye well know." "I've seen him about town," Susan said. She met her aunt's eyes steadily, although it cost her an effort. Lies would follow half-truths as dark followed dusk. "I've seen all three of them about town. Are you satisfied?" No, Susan saw with mounting dismay, she was not. "Do ye swear to me, Susan, on your father's name, that ye have not been meeting this boy, Dearborn?" All the rides in the late afternoon, Susan thought. All the excuses, all the care that no one should see us, and it all comes down to a careless wave on a rainy morning. That easily all's put at risk. Did we think it could be otherwise? Were we that foolish? Yes, and no. The truth was, they had been mad, and still were. Susan kept remembering the look of her father's eyes on the few occasions when he had caught her in a fib. That look of half-curious disappointment, the sense that her fibs, innocuous as they might be, had hurt him like the scratch of a thorn. "I will swear to nothing," she said. "You've no right to ask it of me." "Swear!" Cordelia cried shrilly. She groped out for the table again and grasped it as if for balance. "Swear it! Swear it! This is no game of jacks or tag or Johnny Jump My Pony. Thee's not a child any longer. Swear to me. Swear that thee are still pure." "No," Susan said, and turned to leave. Her heart was beating madly, but still that awful clarity informed the world. Roland would have known it for what it was. She was seeing with gunslinger's eyes. There was a glass window in the kitchen looking out toward the drop, and in it she saw the ghostly reflection of Aunt Cord coming toward her, one arm raised, the hand at the end of it knotted into a fist. Without turning, Susan put up her own hand in a halting gesture. "Raise that knot to me," she said. "Raise it not, ye bitch!" She saw the reflection's ghost eyes widen in shock and dismay. She saw the ghost fist relax, become a hand again, fall to the ghost woman's side. "Susan," Cordelia said in a small, hurt voice, "how can ye call me so? What's so coarsened your tongue and your regard for me?" Susan went out without replying. She crossed the yard and entered the barn. Here the smells she had known since childhood, horses, lumber, hay, filled her head and drove the awful clarity away. She was tumbled back into childhood, lost in the shadows of her confusion again. Pylon turned to look at her and whickered. Susan put her head against his neck and cried. 7. "There," Sheriff Avery said when Size Dearborn and Heath were gone. "It's as you said. Just slow is all they are, just creeping careful." He held the meticulously printed list up, studied it a moment, then cackled happily. "And look at this! What a beauty! Ha! We can move anything we don't want 'em to see days in advance, so we can." "They're fools," Reynolds said. But he pined for another chance at them just the same. If Dearborn really thought bygones were bygones over that little business in the Traveler's Rest, he was way past foolishness and dwelling in the land of idiocy. Deputy Dave said nothing. He was looking disconsolately through his monocle at the castle's board, where his white army had been laid waste in 6 quick moves. Jonas's forces had poured around Red Hillock like water, and Dave's hopes had been swept away in the flood. "I'm tempted to wrap myself up dry and go over to Seafront with this," Avery said. He was still gloating over the paper with its neat list of farms and ranches and proposed dates of inspection, up to year's end and beyond, it ran, gods. "Why don't you do that?" Jonas said and got to his feet. Pain ran up his leg like bitter lightning. "Another game, Si Jonas?" Dave asked, beginning to reset the pieces. "I'd rather play a weed-eaten dog," Jonas said, and took malicious pleasure at the flush that crept up Dave's neck and stained his guileless fool's face. He limped across to the door,
opened it, and went out on the porch. The drizzle had become a soft, steady rain. Hill Street was deserted, the cobbles gleaming wetly. Reynolds had followed him out.
"Eldred, get away,"
Jonas said without turning. Clay hesitated a moment, then went back inside and closed the door.
"What the hell's wrong with you?"
Jonas asked himself. He should have been pleased at the two young pups and their list, as pleased as Avery was, as pleased as Reimer would be when he heard about this morning's visit. After all, hadn't he told Reimer not 3 days ago that the boys would soon be over on the drop, counting their little hearts out? Yes. So why did he feel so unsettled, so fucking jittery? Because there still hadn't been any contact from Farson's man, Letigo? Because Reynolds came back empty from Hanging Rock on one day and DePape came back empty the next? Surely not. Letigo would come, along with a goodly troop of men, but it was still too soon for them, and Jonas knew it. Reaping was still almost a month away. So? Is it just the bad weather working on your leg, stirring up that old wound and making you ugly? No. The pain was bad, but it had been worse before. The trouble was his head. Jonas leaned against a post beneath the overhang, listened to the rain plinking on the tiles, and thought how sometimes in a game of castles a clever player would peek around his hillock for just a moment, then duck back. That was what this felt like. It was so right, it smelled wrong. Crazy idea. But somehow not crazy at all.
"Are you trying to play castles with me, Sprat?"
Jonas murmured.
"If so, you'll soon wish you'd stayed home with your mommy. So you will."
8. Roland and Cuthbert headed back to the barquet along the drop. There would be no counting done today. At first, in spite of the rain and the gray skies, Cuthbert's good humor was almost entirely restored.
"Did you see them?" he asked with a laugh. "Did you see them, Roland? Will, I mean? They bought it, didn't they? Swallowed that honey whole, they did."
"Yes."
"What do we do next? What's our next move?"
Roland looked at him blankly for a moment, as if startled out of a doze. "The next move is theirs. We count, and we wait." Cuthbert's good cheer collapsed in a puff, and he once more found himself having to restrain a flood of recrimination, all whirling around two basic ideas: that Roland was shirking his duty so he could continue to wallow in the undeniable charms of a certain young lady, and, more important, that Roland had lost his wits when all of Midworld needed them the most. Except, what duty was Roland shirking? And what made him so sure Roland was wrong? Logic? Intuition? Or just shitty old catbox jealousy? Cuthbert found himself thinking of the effortless way Jonas had ripped up Deputy Dave's army when Deputy Dave had moved too soon. But life was not like castles, was it? He didn't know. But he thought he had at least one valid intuition. Roland was heading for disaster. And so they all were.
"Wake up," Cuthbert thought. "Please, Roland, wake up before it's too late."
Chapter 3. Playing Castles. 1. There followed a week of the sort of weather that makes folks apt to crawl back into bed after lunch, take long naps, and wake feeling stupid and disoriented. It was far from flood weather, but it made the final phase of the apple-picking dangerous. There were several broken legs, and in Seven Mile Orchard a young woman fell from the top of her ladder, breaking her back, and the potato fields became difficult to work. Almost as much time was spent freeing wagons stuck in the gluey rows as was spent actually picking. In Greenheart, what decorations had been done for the reaping fair grew sodden and had to be pulled down. The work volunteers waited with increasing nervousness for the weather to break so they could begin again. It was bad weather for young men whose job it was to take inventory, although they were at least able to begin visiting barns and counting stock. It was good weather for a young man and young woman who had discovered the joys of physical love, you would have said. But Roland and Susan met only twice during the run of gray weather. The danger of what they were doing was now almost palpable. The first time was in an abandoned boathouse on the Seacoast Road. The second was in the far end of the crumbling building below and to the east of Sitco. They made love with furious intensity on one of Roland's saddle blankets, which was spread on the floor of what had once been the oil refinery's cafeteria. As Susan climaxed, she shrieked his name over and over. Startled pigeons filled the old shadowy rooms and crumbling hallways with their soft thunder. 2. Just as it seemed that the drizzle would never end and the grinding sound of the thinny in the still air would drive everyone in Hambury insane, a strong wind, almost a gale, blew in off the ocean and puffed the clouds away. The town awoke one day to a sky as bright as blue steel and a sun that turned the bay to gold in the morning and white fire in the afternoon. That sense of lethargy was gone. In the potato fields, the carts rolled with new vigor. In Greenheart, an army of women began once more to bedeck with flowers the podium where Jamie McCann and Susan Delgado would be acclaimed this year's reaping lad and girl. Out on the part of the drop closest to Mayor's house, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alan rode with renewed purpose, counting the horses which ran with the Barony brand on their flanks. The bright skies and brisk winds filled them with energy and good cheer, and for a course of days, three or perhaps four, they galloped together in a whooping, shouting, laughing line, their old good fellowship restored. On one of these brisk and sunny days, Eldred Jonas stepped out of the sheriff's office and walked up Hill Street toward Greenheart. He was free of both DePape and Reynolds this morning. They had ridden out to Hanging Rock together, looking for Latigo's outriders, who must come soon now. And Jonas's plan was simple: to have a glass of beer in the pavilion and watch the preparations that were going on there. The digging of the roasting pits, the laying of faggots for the bonfire, the arguments over how to set the mortars that would shoot off the fireworks, the ladies flowering the stage where this year's lad and girl would be offered for the town's adulation. Perhaps, Jonas thought, he might take a likely-looking flower girl off for an hour or two of recreation. The maintenance of the saloon whores he left strictly to Roy and Clay, but a fresh young flower girl of 17 or so was a different matter. The pain in his hip had faded with the damp weather. The painful, lurching stride with which he had moved for the last week or so had become a mere limp again. Perhaps just a beer or two in the open air would be enough. But the thought of a girl wouldn't quite leave his head. Young, clear-skinned, high-breasted, fresh, sweet breath, fresh, sweet lips. Mr. Jonas? Eldred? He turned, smiling, to the owner of the voice. No dewy-complexioned flower girl with wide eyes and moist, parted lips stood there, but a skinny woman edging into late middle age, flat chest, flat bum, tight, pale lips, hair scrooped so tight against her skull that it fair screamed. Only the wide eyes corresponded with his daydream. "I believe I've made a conquest," Jonas thought sardonically. "Why, Cordelia," he said, reaching out and taking one of her hands in both of his. "How lovely you look this morning." Thin color came up in her cheeks, and she laughed a little. For a moment she looked 45 instead of 60. "And she's not 60," Jonas thought. "The lines around her mouth and the shadows under her eyes, those are new." "You're very kind," she said, "but I know better. I haven't been sleeping, and when women my age don't sleep, they grow old rapidly." "I'm sorry to hear you're sleeping badly," he said. "But now that the weather's changed, perhaps..."
"It's not the weather. Might I speak to you, Eldred? I've thought and thought, and you're the only one I dare turn to for advice."
His smile widened. He placed her hand through his arm, then covered it with his own.
Now her blush was like fire. With all that blood in her head, she might talk for hours. And Jonas had an idea that every word would be interesting.
Three. With women of a certain age and temperament, tea was more effective than wine when it came to loosening the tongue. Jonas gave up his plans for a lager and perhaps a flower girl without so much as a second thought. He seated Cy Delgado in a sunny corner of the Greenheart Pavilion, it was not far from a red rock Roland and Susan knew well, and ordered a large pot of tea, cakes too. They watched the reaping fair preparations go forward as they waited for the food and drink. The sun-swept park was full of hammering and sawing and shouts and bursts of laughter.
All fair days are pleasant, but reaping turns us all into children again, don't you find?
Cordelia asked.
Yes, indeed, said Jonas, who hadn't felt like a child even when he had been one. What I still like best is the bonfire, she said, looking toward the great pile of sticks and boards that was being constructed at the far end of the park, catter-corner from the stage. It looked like a large wooden teepee. I love it when the townsfolk bring their stuffy guys and throw them on. Barbaric, but it always gives me such a pleasant shiver.
Aye, Jonas said, and wondered if it would give her a pleasant shiver to know that three of the stuffy guys thrown onto the Reap Night bonfire this year were apt to smell like pork and scream like harpies as they burned. If his luck was in, the one that screamed the longest would be the one with the pale blue eyes. The tea and cakes came, and Jonas didn't so much as glance at the girl's full bosom when she bent to serve. He had eyes only for the fascinating Cy Delgado, with her nervous little shifting movements and odd, desperate look. When the girl was gone, he poured out, put the teapot back on its trivet, then covered her hand with his.
"Now, Cordelia," he said in his warmest tone. I can see something troubles you. Out with it. Confide in your friend Eldred.
Her lips pressed so tightly together that they almost disappeared, but not even that effort could stop their trembling. Her eyes filled with tears, swam with them, overspilled. He took his napkin and, leaning across the table, wiped the tears away.
Tell me, he said tenderly.
I will. I must tell somebody or go mad. But you must make one promise, Eldred.
Of course, Molly.
He saw her blush more furiously than ever at this harmless endearment and squeezed her hand.
Anything.
You mustn't tell Hart, that disgusting spider of a chancellor either, but especially not the mayor. If I'm right in what I suspect, and he found out, he could send her west.
She almost moaned this, as if comprehending it as a real fact for the first time.
He could send us both west.
Maintaining his sympathetic smile, he said,
Not a word to Mayor Thorin, not a word to Kimber Rymer. Promise.
For a moment he thought that she wouldn't take the plunge, or perhaps couldn't. Then, in a low, gaspy voice that sounded like ripping cloth, she said a single word.
Dearborn!
He felt his heart take a bump as the name that had been so much in his mind now passed her lips, and although he continued to smile, he could not forbear a single hard squeeze of her fingers that made her wince.
I'm sorry, he said. It's just that you startled me a little. Dearborn, well spoken enough lad, but I wonder if he's entirely trustworthy.
I fear he's been with my Susan.
Now it was her turn to squeeze, but Jonas didn't mind. He hardly felt it, in fact. He continued to smile, hoping he did not look as flabbergasted as he felt.
I fear he's been with her, as a man is with a woman. Oh, how horrible this is!
She wept with a silent bitterness, taking little pecking peeks around as she did to make sure they were not being observed. Jonas had seen coyotes and wild dogs look around from their stinking dinners in just that fashion. He let her get as much of it out of her system as he could. He wanted her calm. Incoherencies wouldn't help him. And when he saw her tears slackening, he held out a cup of tea.
Drink this.
Yes, thank you.
The tea was still hot enough to steam, but she drank it down greedily.
Her old throat must be lined with slate, Jonas thought.
She set the cup down, and while he poured out fresh, she used her frilly panuelo to scrub the tears almost viciously from her face.
I don't like him, she said. Don't like him, don't trust him. None of those three with their fancy in-world bows and insolent eyes and strange ways of talking, but him in particular. Yet if anything's gone on betwixt the two of them, and I'm so afraid it has, it comes back to her, doesn't it? It's the woman, after all, who must refuse the bestial impulses.
He leaned over the table, looking at her with warm sympathy.
Tell me everything, Cordelia.
She did. 4. Rhea loved everything about the glass ball, but what she especially loved was the way it unfailingly showed her people at their vilest. Never in its pink reaches did she see one child comforting another after a fall at play, or a tired husband with his head in his wife's lap, or old people supping peacefully together at the end of the day. These things held no more interest for the glass, it seemed, than they did for her. Instead, she had seen acts of incest, mothers beating children, husbands beating wives. She had seen a gang of boys out westwards of town. It would have amused Rhea to know these swaggering 8-year-olds called themselves the Big Coffin Hunters, go about enticing stray dogs with a bone and then cutting off their tails for a lark. She had seen robberies and at least one murder, a wandering man who had stabbed his companion with a pitchfork after some sort of trivial argument. That had been on the first drizzly night. The body still lay moldering in a ditch beside the great road west, covered with a layer of straw and weeds. It might be discovered before the autumn storms came to drown another year. It might not. She also glimpsed Cordelia Delgado and that hard gun Jonas sitting in Green Heart at one of the outside tables and talking about, well, of course she didn't know, did she? But she could see the look in the spinster bitch's eyes. Infatuated with him she was, all pink in the face, gone all hot and sweet over a backshooter and failed gunslinger. It was comical, aye. And Rhea thought she would keep an eye on them from time to time. Very entertaining, it would likely be. After showing her Cordelia and Jonas, the glass veiled itself once more. Rhea put it back in the box with the eye on the lock. Seeing Cordelia in the glass had reminded the old woman that she had unfinished business regarding Cordelia's sluttish niece. That Rhea still hadn't done that business was ironic, but understandable. As soon as she had seen how to fix the young size wagon, Rhea's mind and emotions had settled again. The images in the ball had reappeared, and in her fascination with them, Rhea had temporarily forgotten that Susan Delgado was alive. Now, however, she remembered her plan. Set the cat among the pigeons. And speaking of cats...
Musty, you who Musty, where are ye?
The cat came oiling out of the woodpile, eyes glowing in the dirty dimness of the hut. When the weather turned fine again, Rhea had pulled her shutters to, forked tail waving. He jumped into her lap.
I've an errand for ye, she said, bending over to lick the cat.
The entrancing taste of Musty's fur filled her mouth and throat. Musty purred and arched his back against her lips. For a six-legged mutey cat, life was good. 5. Jonas got rid of Cordelia as soon as he could, although not as soon as he would have liked, because he had to keep the scrawny bent sweetened up. She might come in handy another time. In the end, he had kissed her on the corner of her mouth, which caused her to turn so violently red he feared she might have a brainstorm, and told her that he would check into the matter which so concerned her.
But discreetly, she said, alarmed.
Yes, he said, walking her home, he would be discreet. Discretion was his middle name. He knew Cordelia wouldn't, couldn't be eased until she knew for sure, but he guessed it would turn out to be nothing but vapor. Teenagers loved to dramatize, didn't they? And if the young lass saw that her aunt was afraid of something, she might well feed auntie's fears instead of allaying them. Cordelia had stopped by the white picket fence that divided her garden plot from the road, an expression of sublime relief coming over her face. Jonas thought she looked like a mule having its back scratched with a stiff brush.
Why, I never thought of that. Yet it's likely, isn't it?
Likely enough, Jonas had said, but I'll still check into it most carefully, better safe than sorry. He kissed the corner of her mouth again, and not a word to the fellows at Seafront, not a hint.
Thank ye, Eldred. Oh, thank ye.
And she had hugged him before hurrying in, her tiny breasts pressing like stones against the front of his shirt.
Mayhap I'll sleep tonight after all.
She might, but Jonas wondered if he would. He walked toward Hookie's stable, where he kept his horse, with his head down and his hands locked behind his back. A gaggle of boys came racing up the other side of the street. Two of them were waving severed dog's tails with blood clotted at the ends.
"Coffin hunters! We're big coffin hunters, just like you!"
one called impudently across to him. Jonas drew his gun and pointed it at them. It was done in a flash, and for a moment the terrified boys saw him as he really was. With his eyes blazing and his lips peeled back from his teeth, Jonas looked like a white-haired wolf in man's clothes.
"Get on, you little bastards," he snarled. "Get on before I blow you loose of your shoes and give your father's cause to celebrate."
For a moment they were frozen, and then they fled in a howling pack. One had left his trophy behind. The dog's tail lay on the board sidewalk like a grisly fan. Jonas grimaced at the sight of it, holstered his gun, locked his hands behind him again, and walked on, looking like a parson meditating on the nature of the gods. And what in God's name was he doing pulling iron on a bunch of young hellions like that? Being upset, he thought, being worried. He was worried, all right. The titless old biddy's suspicions had upset him greatly. Not on Thorin's account. As far as Jonas was concerned, Dearborn could fuck the girl in the town square at high noon of Reaping Fair Day. But because it suggested that Dearborn might have fooled him about other things. "Crept up behind you once," he did, "and you swore it'd never happen again. But if he's been diddling that girl, it has happened again, hasn't it?" Aye, as they said in these parts. If the boy had had the impertinence to begin an affair with the mayor's Jilly in waiting, and the incredible slyness to get away with it, what did that do to Jonas's picture of three in-world brats who could barely find their own behinds with both hands and a candle? "We underestimated him once, and they made us look like monkeys," Clay had said. "I don't want it to happen again." Had it happened again? How much, really, did Dearborn and his friends know? How much had they found out? And who had they told? If Dearborn had been able to get away with pronging the mayor's chosen to put something that large over on Eldred Jonas, on everyone... "Good day, Si Jonas," Brian Hookie said. He was grinning widely, all but kowtowing before Jonas with his sombrero crushed against his broad blacksmith's chest. "Would you care for fresh graft, Si? I've just gotten the new pressing, and all I want is my horse," Jonas said curtly. "Bring it quick and stop your quacking."
"Aye, so I will. Happy to oblige. Thank you, Si."
He hurried off on the errand, taking one nervous, grinning look back over his shoulder to make sure he wasn't going to be shot out of hand. 10 minutes later, Jonas was headed west on the Great Road. He felt a ridiculous but nevertheless strong desire to simply kick his horse into a gallop and leave all this foolishness behind him. Thorin, the graying goat boy, Roland and Susan with their no doubt mawkish teenage love, Roy and Clay with their fast hands and slow wits, Rhymer with his ambitions, Cordelia Delgado with her ghastly visions of the two of them in some bosky dell, him likely reciting poetry while she wove a garland of flowers for his brow. He had ridden away from things before, when intuition whispered plenty of things. But there would be no riding away this time. He had vowed vengeance on the brats,
and while he had broken a bushel of promises made to others, he'd never broken one made to himself. And there was John Farson to consider. Jonas had never spoken to the good man himself, and never wanted to. Farson was reputed to be whimsically, dangerously insane. But he had had dealings with George Letigo, who would probably be leading the troop of Farson's men that would arrive any day now. It was Letigo who had hired the big coffin hunters in the first place, paying a huge cash advance, which Jonas hadn't yet shared with Reynolds and DePape, and promising an even larger piece of war spoil if the affiliation's major forces were wiped out in or around the Chavez Mountains. Letigo was a good-sized bug, all right, but nothing to the size of the bug trundling along behind him. And besides, no large reward was ever achieved without risk. If they delivered the horses, oxen, wagons of fresh vegetables, the tack, the oil, the glass, most of all the wizard's glass, all would be well. If they failed, it was very likely that their heads would end up being whacked about by Farson and his aides in their nightly polo games. It could happen, and Jonas knew it. No doubt someday it would happen. But when his head finally parted company from his shoulders, the divorce wouldn't be caused by any such smarms as Dearborn and his friends, no matter whose bloodline they had descended from. But if he's been having an affair with Thorin's autumn treat, if he's been able to keep such a secret as that, what others has he been keeping? Perhaps he is playing castles with you. If so, he wouldn't play for long. The first time young Mr. Dearborn poked his nose around his hillock, Jonas would be there to shoot it off for him. The question for the present was where to go first. Out to the bar K to take a long overdue look at the boys' living quarters? He could. They would be counting barony horses on the drop, all three of them. But it wasn't over horses that he might lose his head, was it? No. The horses were just a small added attraction as far as the good man was concerned. Jonas rode for Sitgo instead. 6. First he checked the tankers. They were just as had been and should be, lined up in a neat row with their new wheels ready to roll when the time came, and hidden behind their new camouflage. Some of the screening pine branches were turning yellow at the tips, but the recent spell of rain had kept most admirably fresh. There had been no tampering that Jonas could see. Next, he climbed the hill, walking beside the pipeline and pausing more and more frequently to rest. By the time he reached the rotting gate between the slope and the oil patch, his bad leg was paining him severely. He studied the gate, frowning over the smudges he saw on the top rung. They might mean nothing, but Jonas thought someone might have climbed over the gate rather than risk opening it and having it fall off its hinges. He spent the next hour strolling around the derricks, paying especially close attention to those that still worked, looking for sign. He found plenty of tracks, but it was impossible, especially after a week of wet weather, to read them with any degree of accuracy. The in-world boys might have been out here. That ugly little band of brats from town might have been out here. Arthur Eld and the whole company of his knights might have been out here. The ambiguity put Jonas in a foul temper, as ambiguity other than on a castle's board always did. He started back the way he'd come, meaning to descend the slope to his horse and ride back to town. His leg was aching like fury, and he wanted a stiff drink to quiet it down. The bunkhouse at the Bar K could wait another day. He got halfway to the gate, saw the weedy spur track tying Sitgo to the great road, and sighed. There would be nothing on that little strip of road to see, but now that he'd come all the way out here, he supposed he should finish the job. Bugger finishing the job, I want a damn drink. But Roland wasn't the only one who sometimes found his wishes overruled by training. Jonas sighed, rubbed at his leg, then walked back to the weedy twin ruts. Where, it seemed, there was something to find after all. It lay in the grassy ditch less than a dozen paces from the place where the old road joined the great road. At first he saw only a smooth white shape in the weeds and thought it was a stone. Then he saw a black roundness that could only be an eye hole.
not a stone, then. A skull. Grunting, Jonas knelt and fished it out while the few living Derricks continued to squeal and thump behind him. A rook skull. He had seen it before. Hell, he suspected most of the town had. It belonged to the show-off, Arthur Heath, who, like all show-offs, needed his little props.
He called it the lookout, Jonas murmured. Put it on the horn of his saddle sometimes, didn't he? And sometimes wore it around his neck like a pendant.
Yes, the youngster had been wearing it so that night in the Traveler's Rest when Jonas turned the bird's skull. Something rattled inside, like a last lonely thought. Jonas tilted it, shook it over his open palm, and a fragment of gold chain dropped out. That was how the boy had been wearing it. At some point the chain had broken, the skull had fallen in the ditch, and Cy Heath had never troubled to go looking for it. The thought that someone might find it had probably never crossed his mind. Boys were careless. It was a wonder any ever grew up to be men. Jonas's face remained calm as he knelt there examining the bird's skull. But behind the unlined brow, he was as furious as he had ever been in his life. They had been out here all right. It was another thing he would have scoffed at just yesterday. He had to assume they had seen the tankers, camouflage or no camouflage, and if not for the chance of finding this skull, he never would have known for sure, one way or the other.
When I finish with them, their eye sockets will be as empty as yours, Sir Rook. I'll gouge him clean myself.
He started to throw the skull away, then changed his mind. It might come in handy. Carrying it in one hand, he started back to where he'd left his horse. 7. Coral Thorin walked down High Street toward the Traveler's Rest, her head thumping rustily and her heart sour in her breast. She had been up only an hour, but her hangover was so miserable it felt like a day already. She was drinking too much of late, and she knew it, almost every night now, but she was very careful not to take more than one or two, and always light ones, where folks could see. So far, she thought no one suspected. And as long as no one suspected, she supposed she would keep on. How else to bear her idiotic brother, this idiotic town? And, of course, the knowledge that all of the ranchers in the Horsemen's Association and at least half of the large landowners were traitors.
"Fuck the affiliation," she whispered. "Better a bird in the hand."
But did she really have a bird in the hand? Did any of them? Would Farson keep his promises? Promises made by a man named Letigo and passed on by their own inimitable Kimba Reimer? Coral had her doubts. Despots had such a convenient way of forgetting their promises, and birds in the hand such an irritating way of pecking your fingers, shitting in your palm, and then flying away. Not that it mattered now, she had made her bed. Besides, folks would always want to drink and gamble and rut, regardless of who they bowed their knees to or in whose name their taxes were collected. Still, when the voice of old demon conscience whispered, a few drinks helped to still its lips.